try to get a solid country-to-country agreement on paper. Don't put all your trust in the province of British Columbia.
A hearing on transboundary mine concerns. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, national security experts debate whether Russia is a concern in the Arctic.
I agree that today we are not facing those challenges in the Arctic with Russia, but we've got to operate up there with our eyes wide open.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future. More than 25,000 Alaskans are part of the Salmon Project family. Through stories, news, and a whole lot of salmon love, they're building a statewide community united by salmon. Find them on Facebook and join the conversation. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
The Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation met today in Kenai for an update on the state's progress taking over the gas line project. AGDC President Keith Meyer says the transition should wrap up by the end of the year. But at the meeting, Meyer fielded some tough questions from the board of directors, including this one from Vice Chairman Hugh Short.
What do you say to someone who says AGDC, the state of Alaska, should just hang it up? That you're out there spending state resources and a project that's never going to happen.
Meyer argues the state owes it to its people to take a look at whether it can compete with other LNG projects around the world.
I'm pretty convinced that if you do nothing on this time frame, this go-round, this next window, you've missed it for a number of decades, maybe for longer than that.
This week, Meyer returned from his second trip to Asia in a month. Meyer's traveling to Japan over Thanksgiving to continue marketing the project to government officials and businesses there. Meyer says AGDC is also preparing to open an office in Houston to connect with potential buyers there. The village of Chifornik woke up to a Wednesday morning fire that killed a priest. Officials are investigating the cause. Alaska State Troopers say they received a call yesterday morning around 9:30 saying a house was engulfed in flames and that one person, identified as 72-year-old Catholic Father Theodore Kessler, originally from St. Mary's, died in the fire. Efforts to save him were unsuccessful. Chifornik City Administrator Robert Jimmy told KYUK's Charles Enoch Kessler lived alone in the house.
Father Ted, I think he was alone.
Does he have family in the village?
No.
And how long has he been staying there?
Not long, maybe half an hour. He was a rotating priest.
Jimmy says they are currently not seeking donations or help since no one other than Kessler lived in the house. He was known for being kind to everyone in the village. According to an article by Catholic Anchor, Father Kessler was born in Tacoma, Washington, along with his twin sister, Mary Ann. He was ordained in 1975, and 5 years later, he heard there was a need for more priests in Alaska and volunteered with a group to move north. Since then, he's taken on leadership and other roles in the state. Wednesday, troopers said a deputy from the fire marshal's office was on the way to investigate the cause of the fire. Russia is antagonizing the U.S. on multiple fronts these days, in Europe, in Syria, and in cyberspace, if claims prove true that Moscow is behind some high-profile email hacks. But in the Arctic, Russia is still playing nice. That's one conclusion a panel of national security experts made at a Washington, D.C. briefing today. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Russia has built up its military on its side of the Arctic. It has installed or refurbished Arctic bases, enlarged ports, and built new airfields.
But the fact is there's really no evidence of aggressive intent by Russia.
Julia Gorley, the senior Arctic official at the State Department, says it appears Russia is gearing up to protect its economic interests. It has offshore oil wells.
Frankly, all countries would do the same.
Gorley spoke at a Capitol Hill briefing for congressional staff. Reports of a massive Russian land grab have been circulating since 2007, when a Russian submarine planted a flag on the Arctic seabed at the North Pole. Russia has submitted a claim to a UN commission for more Arctic territory based on how far it says its continental shelf extends into the ocean. The documents aren't public, but Gourley says the State Department believes Russia did not make an outlandish claim.
In determining its outer limits of the continental shelf, so far there are no overlaps with the United States from what we know of its submission.
John Pendleton, a military expert at the Government Accountability Office, agreed it's likely Arctic warfare is not on the horizon.
I'll pause there and make sure you understand that the DOD has assessed the threat of military conflict, and we have it from several sources, as low in the near term. Armed conflict.
Sherry Goodman, though, is more wary. She's a former Pentagon official and now a think tank fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. She says the U.S. needs to assert its military presence in the Arctic and remain alert for changes in Russia, for signs it may be resurgent in the North as it is elsewhere.
I agree that today we are not facing those challenges in the Arctic with Russia, but we've got to operate up there with our eyes wide open.
All of the panelists concurred on the need for more icebreakers and for Arctic ports. They were speaking to a room full of congressional aides, the people who work for the people who could fund such projects. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Critics of British Columbia Mining told a legislative committee Wednesday about the dangers of mineral extraction along transboundary rivers. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports on some of the testimony before the House Fisheries Committee.
Tribal leaders, scientists, fishermen, and community members warned officials of the consequences of a cross-border mining disaster. The focus was on the Taku, Unik, and Stikine rivers, which begin in British Columbia and flow through southeast Alaska to the ocean. One speaker was Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska President Richard Peterson. He pointed to last year's Mount Polly mine disaster when a dam holding back silty polluted water broke and spilled millions of gallons into nearby waterways.
We're terrified that that's what's going to happen here and that we're going to share their fate. And we couldn't sustain our traditional way of life. We couldn't sustain our economic way of life if that happened.
The BC government and the mine owner have said the Mount Polly spill caused no long-term damage. But Frederick Olson Jr. of the United Tribal Transboundary Mining Work Group said the impacts have been underplayed.
When you call something a tailings storage facility, you treat it a lot differently than you would treat a lake of poison that's held back by sand. But that is what we have. Mount Polly had a lake of poison held back by sand, and it was supposed to last forever, but it lasted fewer than 20 years.
The Fisheries Committee heard from several scientists who addressed the frequency and impacts of mine spills. One was Center for Science and Public Participation founder Dave Chambers. He said his research shows falling metal prices and rising costs, putting a lot of pressure on mines to increase production.
We're seeing an increasing number, actually a fairly constant rate, but an increasing number of large tailings dam failures because they're being built and operated by companies under financial stress.
The state and British Columbia recently signed a statement of cooperation on transboundary mining. It promised Alaskans will play a larger role in resource development planning and permitting. But tribal or First Nations leaders from across the border warned that the province has a bad track record of living up to such deals. Bev Sellers chairs First Nations Women advocating responsible mining.
My recommendation, based on my lifelong experience with the BC government, and you can ask any Indigenous person in BC, they would say the same thing, is to try to get a solid country-to-country agreement on paper. Don't put all your trust in the province of British Columbia.
She said the state should instead push for involvement of the International Joint Commission. That's a U.S.-Canada panel charged with resolving boundary water disputes. The Walker-Mulott administration and Alaska's congressional delegation have asked for that action. I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a whale carcass on an Anchorage beach is flown off for science.
This is a unique opportunity to get a humpback whale, which we don't have a full skeleton representation of at the museum.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Researchers were at Kincaid Beach in Anchorage this week to finish recovering the skeleton of the humpback whale that washed up there in July. The massive specimen will become part of the largest marine mammal collection in North America, housed at the University of Alaska Museum in Fairbanks. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Eric Keto reports it wasn't easy to collect all the pieces.
Aaron Gunderson is scouring the muddy Kincaid Beach for pieces of humpback whale.
So there's one flipper over there. There's another one over here. That's a flipper there. All right.
It's not every day he encounters such a large specimen this close to the road system in Alaska. So, in September, he brought a team to this beach to begin recovering the entire whale skeleton.
This is a unique opportunity to get a humpback whale, which we don't have a full skeleton representation of at the museum. So, with this being as accessible as it is, it'd be a shame not to take advantage of it and come here and collect the whole thing.
The team was able to carry many of the bones off the beach themselves. They lashed vertebrae, about 40 pounds each, to their backpacks and hauled them a quarter of a mile up the steep, sandy bank. But there was no way they could carry the 2,000-pound whale skull, so Gunderson called in a helicopter.
Get back!
He clips a dangling hook onto some thick straps wrapped around the skull.
All right, good to go.
The skull is dropped onto a flatbed trailer and is being trucked up to Fairbanks. The ribs and jawbones are making the journey by pickup truck. It's been a massive effort, but Gunderson says it's worth it.
Bones in particular, all the tissues of an animal, have recorded the history of the animal, what it's eaten. It can teach us a lot about the environment, what's happening out in the oceans where it's living.
The museum's research collection is used by scientists around the world, including medical researchers hoping to understand the secrets of animal longevity. For now, Gunderson is looking forward to getting the bones out of the pickup truck and into the ground for winter. They need to decompose a bit more before they're ready for research or display at the museum. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Eric Keto in Anchorage.
You can find a video of the salvage operation by searching for Alaska's Energy Desk on Facebook. Audubon Alaska recently released an atlas showing where the most valuable salmon streams and bird habitat are located in Southeast. It also identifies the biggest threats to those areas. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins reports.
Spread across 200 pages, the Ecological Atlas of the region includes a lot more than maps. Melanie Smith, the Director of Conservation Science for Audubon Alaska, says the organization wanted to create something both policymakers and regular people could use. It follows in the footsteps of other atlases Audubon has released about the Arctic and Western Alaska. Smith says this latest Southeast edition is another comprehensive overview that helps provide context.
What do we know about how this place works and why it matters and what types of considerations we should be thinking about when we're thinking about a sustainable future for Southeast and the Tongass?
The atlas features bear viewing hotspots and birding locations, but also what Audubon Alaska believes are human-caused dangers to these environments, like old-growth clear-cut logging. Smith says what surprised her the most while putting the atlas together is how quickly the climate is changing.
I'm sorry to say, Southeast Alaska is supposed to become a little bit of a wetter place.
The region has enjoyed a recent sunny streak, but Smith says in the future, more rain could be in the forecast due to warming. Climate projections suggest a 2-degree temperature rise by the year 2050.
Which also has implications for how productive salmon populations may be. So there's this chain of possible effects.
Smith says less snowpack and more downpours could affect where salmon lay eggs in nearby streams. But for now, the atlas shows where the fishing is ripe in Southeast and she hopes that encourages readers to keep it that way. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
An annual report on Southeast Alaska's economy re-examines housing, jobs, and other signposts for Juneau over the past year. KTOO's Quentin Chandler spoke with Juneau City Manager about this year's findings.
In 2015, Juneau gained more young people and seniors, cost of living fell slightly, unemployment remained steady, and the housing market was still tight. Those are highlights from a report compiled by the Juneau Economic Development Council on changes to Juneau's economy between 2014 and 2015. In the housing market, prices rose, and turnaround times for single-family homes and condominiums were still quick. According to the JEDC, home sales went up 10% last year. Juneau City Manager Rory Watt is concerned there aren't enough vacancies for residents to shop around and find the homes they want.
The general comment is that our housing market is stuck, and we're not seeing enough investment to keep our housing stock up to a good standard, and we're not seeing enough investment to bring enough housing onto the market.
He's also concerned with the availability of good jobs in town and the ability for workers to find appropriate housing. He couldn't say how many new housing units were actually built in Juneau last year. The number of new homes built in Southeast in 2015 was down by more than 38%. Watt says this is a sign of concern for the region's future.
But then I would also point out that in Juneau, we had a pretty good year last year for new housing permits. And I think that's probably a reflection of our ability to diversify our economy over the years.
He says Juneau's economy is more balanced and less dependent on the state. He says the city's role in addressing the problem will be selling city property and starting programs to encourage housing development.
You know, our first step 6 months ago was hiring our housing officer, Scott Chambor, and I can tell you his phone is ringing off the hook because there are a zillion things that people want to talk to the city about with regards to housing.
In population trends, JEDC reports Juneau grew slightly between 2014 and 2015. It's grown steadily for the last 10 years. Last year, the number of people aged 20 to 39 grew, 40 to 59 shrank. The number of seniors also grew. Watt says the increase in seniors is no surprise. He pointed out there's also been a strong increase in school-aged children and says he isn't sure what the increase in young adults will mean for Juneau.
I think that's good because one of our overriding concerns is that younger people and their ability to find employment and be able to afford to live here is one of our concerns. So I'm happy to see a little bit of growth in that sector.
The cost of living in Juneau has been decreasing for a couple of years. In 2015, the cost of living was 28% higher than the national average. Watt saw no surprises there. As recently as 2012, U.S. News and World Report identified Juneau as the 10th most expensive U.S. city to live in. The JEDC report shows unemployment fell slightly to 4%, but there was also a 4% drop in state employment, the largest decrease in a decade. Watt says that was expected. The report predicts an even bigger loss in state jobs this year. In Juneau, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message is sponsored by OPAG.
Though the cause of a fatal plane crash near Togiak is not yet determined, the National Transportation Safety Board has released a few details about the flight. According to a preliminary NTSB report, the flight originated in Bethel on October 2nd and made stops in Togiak and Quinnahock. The Cessna 208 was on its way back to Togiak before crashing about 12 miles northwest of its destination. The NTSB says the plane's initial point of impact was at 2,300 feet, 200 feet below the mountain summit. Two pilots, Timothy Klein, age 43, and Drew Welty, age 29, and one passenger, 49-year-old Louis John, all died in the crash. The country's farthest north alpine ski area is getting a facelift. Skiland, operated since 1962 on Mount Aurora, 20 miles north of Fairbanks, is undergoing major changes. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the area was sold last year, and the new owners have been busy in the off-season.
After more than 50 years of operation, Skiland was starting to go downhill. The area's infrastructure was aging, and when its longtime operators called it quits, the owners decided to sell. Fairbanks doctors Andrew and Jacqueline Cox bought Skiland and hired DJ Larson to manage the area and oversee numerous renovations.
Just a whole host of things to kind of bring Skiland into its next phase of existence and ensure it has a nice long future.
Larson lists several off-season modernization projects, including overhaul of Skiland's chairlift.
Redoing the load and unload ramps, which let us spin the lift a little faster. Revamped both lodges. A lot of groundwork around, including building a brand new learning area, so there's somewhere safe to start out if you've never skied before.
Larson adds that the area's rental fleet has been expanded, and a terrain park is being constructed with rails, boxes, and other park infrastructure from the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
They wanted a terrain park. We had one.
UAF Director of Recreation, Adventure, and Wellness Mark Oldmixon says private funding was running out for the campus terrain park, and the university agreed to transfer its park equipment, including a snowcat grooming machine, to Skiland.
And then, in exchange, students will get a season's pass.
Oldmixon says the UAF Terrain Park's short walk-up run was great for tricks and jumps, but Skiland provides a full-service facility for all levels of skiers and boarders. Skiland is home to a local alpine skiing tradition Jeff Fay has been a part of since the late 1960s.
At this point, I'm still the voice of Skiland. I'm the guy who does the ski report in the morning.
Fay was a board member of the company that formerly owned Skiland and says he feels good about what's been happening since they sold the area.
So far, it has been just a wonderful thing. There's lots of really positive change and energy, and the community that Skiland has been for years is continuing.
Fay credits DJ Larson's energetic management with the ongoing transformation of Skiland. One other change being implemented this season is an increase in daily lift ticket prices and a drop in season pass rates. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The lack of reliable childcare options in the Bristol Bay Borough impacts parents, children, employers, and the community at large. A group of residents is working on a solution. They now have $80,000 from the borough to develop a certified childcare center. Recently, Avery Lill from KDLG toured the room where they hope to house the program.
It is probably about 1,600 square feet and has very old carpet and old linoleum. And we are looking at renovating it and turning it into a safe and beautiful place for children to learn and for teachers to reflect on their learning.
That's Esther Pepin. She and her 7-month-old son Leo sit with me on the floor of an empty room in the Bristol Bay Borough School. Pepin taught kindergarten and pre-kindergarten in this classroom last year, but after Leo was born, she couldn't find available, reliable childcare.
I had to quit my job so that I could take care of my 7-month-old. I was a teacher, and I love being a stay-at-home mom, but when I became one, I realized that my story was reflected in people on a weekly basis. I would see public postings for, I need a babysitter, I have to go to work, I have a job, I have to meet my rent, and I need somebody to take care of my kid.
There are no certified child care centers in the Naknek, South Naknek, and Kingsowen communities that make up the Bristol Bay Borough where Pepin lives. In March, she and a group of Bristol Bay residents began meeting to discuss the problem, which they say frequently leads parents to quit their jobs or move away. Their solution? Little Angels Child Care Academy. The nonprofit has acquired a facility use contract to rent the room where Pepin used to teach. Sharon Thompson has been a part of the planning committee from the beginning. she recently turned down a job offer because she could not find reliable childcare. Thompson explains the vision of the program.
You know, the brain develops so rapidly during those first couple years of life. The potential for learning and the need for nurturing and safe and consistent care of children is just critical. And that's what we want to address. There's a lot of people who are struggling, and it's not just childcare. It's early childhood education.
In order to be licensed with the state of Alaska, the facility for Little Angels needs to be ready for inspection. So, on Monday, they took it to the Bristol Bay Borough Assembly meeting to ask for $100,000 in development funds. About a dozen business owners, parents, and childcare workers spoke in support of the program. Local resident Dave Lax explains how he sees the lack of childcare affect the community.
As an employer, we have three young people working for us now that all suffer from the childcare issue. And for a small community like us, I think it's a tough challenge to try to develop a childcare center that can support that need that the companies in town need to have to be able to hire people and provide quality jobs.
The borough approved a donation of $80,000. Carl Anderson, mayor of the Bristol Bay Borough, said after the vote that childcare is something the community needs.
Being a young parent myself, I know we had times where it was hard to find a babysitter or hard to drive all the way across town to drop off a babysitter. So I'm excited for other people to have the opportunity to get what they need.
Little Angels Child Care Academy still has a lot of work to do, but they look forward to opening their doors to their first 10 students on their target start date of January 1st, 2017. For KDLG, I'm Avery Lill.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh, Josh Edge, and Eric Keddo in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Charles Enoch in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld, Elizabeth Jenkins, and Quentin Chandler in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Avery Lill in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. It's a fact. 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.